From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with the author Carlos Allende, whose new novel, which comes out tomorrow, I believe, is Coffee, Shopping, Murder, Love. The book won the 2019 Quill Prose Award from Red Hen Press. Carlos Allende is a media psychology scholar and a writer of fiction. He has written two previous novels, Cuadrillas y Contradanzas, a historical melodrama set during the War of Reform in Mexico, and Love or the Witches of Windward Circle, a horror farce set in Venice, California. Based on his research on narrative persuasion and audience engagement, he developed the course The Psychology of Compelling Storytelling, which he teaches in the writer's program at UCLA Extension. He lives in Santa Monica with his husband. Here's the publisher's summary of Coffee, Shopping, Murder, Love, which they call a campy dark comedy for the angry and the disenchanted. It's in the voice of one of the characters. Last November, I found a dead body inside the freezer that my roommate keeps inside the garage. My first thought was to call the police, but Jignesh hadn't paid his share of the rent just yet. It wasn't due until the 30th, and you know how difficult it is to find people who pay on time. Jignesh always does. Also, he had season tickets for the LA Opera and, well, Madame Butterfly, Tosca, The Flying Dutchman. At the Dorothy Chandler, you cannot say no to that, can you? Well, it's been a few good months now. Madame Butterfly was just superb, thank you. However, last Friday I found a second body inside that stupid freezer in the garage. This time I'm evicting Jignesh. My house isn't a mortuary. Alas, I need to come up with some money first. You'll understand, therefore, that I desperately need to sell this novel. Just enough copies to help me survive until I find a job. What could I do that doesn't demand too much effort? We have a real treasure here, anyhow. Some chapters are almost, but not quite, pornographic. You could safely lend this to Nana afterward. So, that is a little information about Coffee, Shopping, Murder, Love, just out from Red Hen Press. My interview with Carlos begins with my asking my first question. I hope you enjoy our conversation. The book is on, you know, one of the publisher's lines about the book is that it's a campy dark comedy for the angry, which caught my interest. It is definitely a campy dark comedy, but that for the angry made me wonder, like, is this generally for the angry? Is this for a specific kind of anger? Do you envision an audience of readers who are perhaps angry about being outcasts and if so, is that about being gay, or is it for anybody at all who feels like they don't fit in?
I think it's for everybody who's angry at several points. And I mean, we have many, many reasons to be angry, and sometimes we don't allow to be angry. And I'm not saying that people should be angry, but sometimes if you read something like this and you're angry, it will improve your mood. It will reduce your anger because you're going to laugh.
Yes.
So, It's the book is a little bit of a way of misbehaving without actually misbehaving. And, so you enjoy the shenanigans of Jignesh and Charlie, and I think it can reduce your anger a little bit.
How about writing it? Did it reduce your anger, or did you get more angry as you were writing?
Oh no! It did, and I had a lot of fun writing it. But at one point, I remember, okay, I have to take a break because these people are horrible. So I started working on another book, which is the one that I'm trying to finish now. So I did take my break, and then I returned to this book. Not too long, just a little bit. Whenever it got too bitter, then I knew I had to stop, do something else and improve it, make it funny and remind myself this is first and foremost a comedy. And
yeah, that's interesting. You know, they are fairly despicable characters, and yet we kind of root for them, which is weird. And it's really interesting how you do that. And I want to ask you about that. First, I'm just going to talk a little bit about who these characters are so listeners understand what we're talking about. So early on, your character named Charlie, he enumerates some of the mortifying memories he has of being a child, being, you know, gay, being bullied, being hurt. And at one point, he says, traumatic incident from my childhood, number 42. And it struck me that by counting them in this way, he kind of flips this... it's kind of a flippant way of talking, which makes it funny. On the other hand, it makes it sad because this is number 42 and there are a lot of others following it. So a paragraph or two later, he says, or he reflects, the more you feel sorry for yourself, the better it feels. There's a beauty in sadness. And I thought that was really poignant. And I think that's throughout this book. There's humor, there's sadness, and there's like this poignant undercurrent of recognition. So I wonder if you can talk a little bit about this beauty and sadness in terms of your writing?
Well, that's actually, I'm a media psychologist and I study how we engage with narratives. So that's part of my research. When we're sad, we feel pain and it's very similar to physical pain. I mean, we don't feel it in our body as pain when you get hurt physically, but you still feel it and you cannot define exactly where, but it hurts, and we release endorphins to reduce that pain. So there's some, it's like your body is soothing yourself when you do that. And I was researching why we enjoy sad stories. And I know why we enjoy them, but I don't know exactly what is the neurochemical mechanism. Based on what I have read and the research of others, I think what suits you is not really so much endorphins, but oxytocin, and which also has an analgesic effect. So when you, it's like if your body is trying to comfort yourself, and I wanted to put a little bit of that. And going back to the novel, Charlie is, both of them are like two extremes, the consequence of living a life of abuse, I said. So their lives are not super ultra terrible, but they have been bad and they have been victims of society. And when you're gay, you're a little bit messed up, not because you're gay, but because of society. So newer, the younger generations have it easier. It's not perfect yet, far from it, but compared to people my age and older, we were born in a time in which we had no hopes of ever getting married or even having a steady boyfriend. I mean, some people did, but you had to choose between your family and your partner or your work and your gay life, etc. And you don't have to anymore. Not everywhere. It's not perfect, but for many people, it is much easier and better. And so they represent that this generation where suddenly things changed, and things changed very fast. And Jignesh's anger and bitterness, and because he's big, I guess, and Charlie represents superficiality and trying to get rescued by someone else. So he's finding comfort in his own sadness. It's as if he's waiting for Prince Charming to come and rescue him.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, great. Now, I kind of had written out what I thought of these characters, and it really echoes what you just said. Charlie is sweet, but needy, and he wants money, and he wants love. He very much wants love and money. And your other main character, as you said, is Jignesh, and he's pretty obnoxious, but very early in the book, that turns quite dark. And I feel like that made it harder to come around to having any sympathy for his perspective, because I don't like giving things away, but it gets very dark very quickly. So both of these characters are flawed, and yet we root for them. So I wonder if you can just talk about how you conceived of them and how you expect your reader to react to each of them.
Well, not everybody loves them, but I mean, for the most part, they have been welcome and people like them. Some people like Jignesh better, some people like Charlie better. But generally it works and people accept them and have fun and end up rooting for them. And that's what I wanted. And it was part of a personal challenge that I imposed on myself. So traditionally we say that we like characters that behave, that we make a judgment of morality, and we like characters that behave well, and we dislike characters that misbehave. But I think that's not true. I totally reject that idea, and I wanted to demonstrate that it's wrong with my novel. So I said, I'm going to create the most unlikable characters, and I'm going to make them highly immoral, and I'm going to make readers still root for them. And once you know how, it is actually very easy, and the secret is just compassion. And if you feel compassion for these characters, you root for them. I teach writing, and I tell my students, we don't root for likable characters only because we like them. We root them when they arouse our compassion. So characters like Quasimodo, for instance, nobody thinks of Quasimodo as a villain. We think of him as a victim, but he kills a lot of people in the novel. I mean, not the Disney movie. In the novel, he kills a lot of people. He kidnaps Esmeralda. He's really messed up, but you feel sorry for him because of his deformity and his suffering, his death. And what he wants is to be loved and accepted. And you come to understand that, and you feel sorry for him. So you root for him. And so the secret is just to arouse the reader's compassion. And for that, you need to be extremely clear on how the character feels, because mm-hmm. we use the affective state of the character as a guide of how we should feel ourselves. So after Jignesh commits his crime, we can understand his desperation, and we feel empathy for that desperation, and it derives into compassion. Whether it's deserved or not, it's not important, because with all mammals, I like to insist that compassion is not only a human emotion. It's common to all mammals and to all social animals. I don't know if ants feel compassion the way we do, but they tend to protect the weak and the vulnerable, and bees. And I mean, it's something that we share with social animals. Maybe not in the same way, but we share that tendency to help the other.
It's interesting. There are moments in this book where, well, so I'm going to back up. So early on, it's shared with us that Charlie and Jignesh met through like a dating app, and they went out, and Jignesh early in the book is receiving just like a huge number of texts from Charlie. Charlie is, and you know, we've all been there. It's just like, oh, I'm just going to send one really cool text. And then you don't get an answer. And you're like, well, I need to send another one and just make sure. But Charlie has got this problem bad. So, so Jignesh, in his narrative point of view, in his mind, he's mocking Charlie's neediness. He's going through these texts, and then he finds one that's a meme mocking Mitt Romney's attacks on PBS, which is something we remember from an earlier election. And and so Jignesh thinks, I'll share that. We cannot lose this election. And it was just there's just so many tiny little moments where there are just wonderful ways of showing us who these characters are, ways of making teeny tiny little jokes that were awesome. You know, I mean, it's just like that moment where he's dissing Charlie, dissing him. And all of a sudden it's like, that's a good one. I'm going to share that one. And I think that also shows us early on that there may in fact be a nice rapport between these characters eventually, even though they start off really rocky. So I don't know, when you're working, how conscious an effort are you making at these teeny tiny things, or does it just kind of all come out and then you have to kind of work with it later?
Well, I gotta say that Charlie is based on a very good friend of mine who's reading the book. In case he's taking his time, but He's reading the book. He loves the idea that I based a book on him. He's actually wonderful. He's very smart. He's very friendly. He talks and talks and talks and talks like Charlie. But he's aware of that. He makes fun of that. He has tried stand-up comedy because of that. His voice is like Charlie's.
Yeah.
And he's from the South too. And I just thought, you're such a wonderful character. I have to write about you. And he knows it's about horrible people. And I, at first he wasn't too enchanted about the idea, but now he likes it. And so I didn't have much time to write the book. And I was tired of doing research. And I started like every, not with this book, but with previous books. I started like every novice writer, I wanted to imitate the classics, and I was inspired by Victor Hugo and Balzac and Tolstoy, and I wanted to use nice language and stuff. And when I started this book, I was like, well, I'm tired of that. I'm not gonna do any research. I'm just gonna write whatever comes out. And I was attending a workshop, a writing club called Writer's Block. We were like 50 people in a church just typing. And I had only 2 hours every week. And I think from an interview with Hayao Miyazaki, I heard that he starts by imagining visuals that he wants to see in his movie. So I said, oh, I'm going to do the same. I'm just going to write the scenes that I want to see in my story. And I'm not going to worry about linking them until much later. And that's what I did. I typed, and I was thinking a lot about the novel while I was not there. But then when I went there every week, I would just type, and then worry about editing much later. And it took a lot of edits. Like every time that I sent it and I got a rejection, I went back and changed my letter.
Uh-huh.
And I actually added the prologue as an afterthought after the book was finished. I said, yeah, you're right. I mean, you don't, my intention is for the reader to root for Jignesh, but you can't do it on the first chapter. So I need that prologue. So you have to root for someone. So you're going to start rooting for Charlie.
Mm.
Then eventually you will root for both of them.
Yeah.
And I added the prologue. I realized it was necessary.
Yeah. Okay, great.
But about the jokes, I guess they just come out. I was putting myself in the skin of Charlie, and I said, "What would my friend Christopher would say?" and once you put in yourself into the skin of someone else, it's very easy.
Now, I want to ask, this wasn't a question I had thought about, but in hearing you speak and in seeing your name, where are you from? Are you?
I was born in Mexico City. And I grew up in La Paz in Baja, and then I moved to Los Angeles in 2009.
So do you think that your background, like, how does humor translate when you are writing in what I assume maybe wasn't your first language? So what does that mean? Does that mean anything or not?
Yeah. Mexican humor is different. It's very self-deprecating. And I don't know if you have heard of the show El Chavo del Ocho, which was very extremely popular in Latin America. I mean, Spain. And
El Chavo de Ocho?
El Ocho. It means the guy from apartment 8.
Ah.
And so it's very self-replicating. It's about poor people living in a vecindad, which is like an apartment complex, very small, very poor, and he doesn't have a home. Well, he actually has a home, but you'd never see it. He doesn't have parents and stuff. He lives out of charity, but it's a comedy. And then there's another one, a comic book called La Familia Burrón, The Burrón Family, and it's also about very poor people. And everybody in Mexico knows Nosotros los Pobres, We the Poor. So we tend to make a lot of jokes about people in desperate circumstances. Not about them, but, well, we follow them. And the humor is about, it's not always good, because you're laughing about the lives of miserable losers, But that's a kind of humor that we like in Mexico. And it's very different from American humor, because American is always a winner, the superhero, like we're going to do better and blah, blah, blah. And then I have been very, very influenced by Balzac. He's my favorite writer. And I have read not all of it, but I would say at least half of the Human Comedy. And he loves his villains. He absolutely loves despicable people, and also being gay. I think this is important. You grow up thinking that you're wrong, that you're a pervert, and there's something wrong with you, and because that's what society teaches you. And hopefully, new generations don't have that feeling anymore. So you identify with the villains a lot, and. I always mention the Disney villains like Ursula, who's based on Divine, and Prince John from Robin Hood, and even Cruella de Vil is very campy, and she looks like a drag queen and stuff. And we love that kind of humor because it reflects who you are and how you have been told to perceive yourself as a bad guy. So. I don't know about the other gay people, but I tend to, not always, but I tend to feel for villains. I try to understand them and try to empathize with them, try to understand their pain and the motivations behind their crimes.
Right. Well, I have a question about villains, kind of. So there's a character in the book called Nina. There's another character in the book called Justin. And without going into detail about what their role is in the book, I will just say that they are important antagonists in the book. Mm-hmm. Whether or not I think they're villains, I mean, I did not like these people. Uh-huh. And I wondered if you can just speak to the importance of an antagonist to comic narrative.
Well, originally Nina was nicer, but I realized I had to manipulate the way the reader felt about her because it was important that they understood Jignesh. So I emphasized her meanness. And so I guess I don't know, by the end of the book, I wanted to emphasize that that she didn't deserve what happened to her. And but you need to control, you need to manipulate the reader's affective dispositions. So we don't judge people by what they do only, but by what they do and the circumstances. Mm-hmm. And in the case of Nina, you don't know exactly her circumstances. You know a little bit. The background you're seeing the background from Jignesh's point of view. You're only witness to what she does to Jignesh. So you judge her based on that. And the same with Justin, you only get Jignesh's perspective, which is pretty biased.
Absolutely.
But you need to do that with your novel. You need to manipulate how the reader will feel about them.
Absolutely. Okay, great. I'm still very much at the beginning of the book here because I have so many questions about how you set things up. So when I got to Jignesh's self-assessment of middle-aged Indian fatty is how he refers to himself. And now you've kind of explained that there's a lot of self-deprecation in the humor. But I wondered if you found it a risk to adopt a narrative voice from another culture. And he's not a particularly admirable narrative voice. And writing is so political now. I mean, you have to be super careful. On the other hand, you're writing a book that's not particularly careful. So I don't know. I wondered, as I was thinking about this, are there politics that you'll political correctness that you'll step away from? Or embrace? And also, you know, in some ways, does gay maybe eclipse ethnicity? And what you're really writing about is the gay community and their ethnicity. I mean, his ethnicity comes into the book, though. I mean, he's close to his family. So I'm just curious what your thoughts are.
That was in purpose because originally I wanted to have an evil character. And I was, because I didn't want to spend much time trying to figure out who these characters were. I said, I'm going to base my characters on real people. And first, the guy, Jignesh, was a very fuzzy, vague idea. And I was going to get inspired by another friend who's white. And but then I said, doesn't work. And then a very dear good friend of mine, who's lovely, who's charming, who's very smart, makes me laugh a lot. It's funny. He's Indian American, and we were working with a German girl who. And they were very good friends. They love each other. And I thought it was funny seeing them. And then I'm gonna write about Jignesh. And I thought we need more representation. So that is something that I strive. I think I cannot do it, of course, because there are, I don't know how many nationalities in LA, like, I don't know, 500 languages, I don't know, or 300, I don't know. But there's a lot of diversity in Los Angeles. And so I said, I'm not going to, if you don't mention the race or the ethnicity of your characters, we go to the white default, which yes. is what we have seen always over. So I tell my students, if you want more diversity, you have to make the ethnicity of your character salient. So people know. And then I thought, well, I'm being inspired by a guy that is Indian American, so I'm going to stay with that. And I don't know a lot, but I know a few Indian Americans, and everybody's very, when I ask them questions about their culture and about their family, they're very happy to answer. I think people are afraid to ask questions. We shouldn't be afraid.
Right.
I mean, some people get offended when they ask, where are you from? What is your background? But it's just normal. I mean, we are curious. It's not because we want to judge you. It's because we're curious and we want to know a lot about you. I mean, it can get annoying. A lot of people ask me where I'm from. And I'm,
like me?
Yeah. And I'm happy to say it. And I lived in Holland. I lived in Belgium for a year and then in Holland. And in Belgium, nobody asks you questions. Nobody. And people are very to themselves and cold.
Interesting.
And Holland is like a tropical country almost. People are so happy and cheery and they ask all kinds of questions. And I was just on the train minding my own business and people would come and ask me, oh, where are you from? And what are you doing? But in a friendly way. And eventually it gets a little bit annoying because it happens every day. But it was nice that people cared. And so I wanted to make their background salient. And yes, there's a risk if you're writing about another culture, but if you don't take a risk, I mean, the dominant group is white people still, and you should use your privilege to include other people. And my students think, oh, I cannot write about black people because I'm not black and I don't know about them. And well, if you don't write about them, if you're going to wait for them to write about themselves when they still don't have as much power as your social group does, you have a responsibility to include people. So I encourage my students, and I try to do it myself, to have characters from all kinds of backgrounds and add them and then have fun of it with them. And I think gentle teasing is okay. And I hope, my writing that nobody gets offended. So far, the Indian American people that have read it loved it. Someone may get offended.
I think part of what you're saying, one thing that you said makes me think, you know, a lot of the new rules are by the younger generation. Have been, and a lot of the way things used to be with I will call myself part of an older generation, there, you know, everybody always asked where your people were from. Even if you looked just like a white person, it would sort of be, you know, because America was like the melting pot. That's what everybody knew. And so it's like, where are your people from? It was like the question that would get asked, you know, and sometimes the answer was England and sometimes the answer was Australia, whatever. And we found it fascinating. Now it's a little bit offensive. You have to be careful who, you know, when younger people find it like they're being pigeonholed, and that is so, it's just interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, they're going to grow old and they're going to understand that it's fine. I mean, I was woke when I was 20. I'm still a progressive. I want to think about that of myself, but I'm not as worried about being.
Oh yeah, no, I
politically correct all the time.
I'm also not criticizing or in any way saying anything was wrong in this book. Now let's talk a little bit about Jignesh is a writer. He writes about Princess Salmonella McFallig. And it's a fantasy novel that he's working on called Catacombs of the Shining Fear. That was just fun. And at one point he finds out somebody who he dislikes is reading his book and laughing at it. And still he thinks, I'm so flattered, a reader. So that was great.
Yeah, and he's writing about the white princess living in Scotland with red hair. So in a way, it was like my criticism of how we have been imposed an ideal. And
yeah.
And that's what he's writing
that's
about.
Absolutely, and yeah.
That's why I insist so much. We have to include more people from all backgrounds and not only beautiful people. That's why I made a point, like neither Jignesh and Charlie are that much that attractive. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I like my characters oddly and evil.
Yeah. they're also self-aware though, which is good. You know, there's a moment where Jignesh is saying, okay, I may have been making Nina's life miserable for the last 4 months, continually breaking the coffee pot and forcing her to go buy coffees for everyone, never reimbursing her on time. You know, he goes on and on and on. So there's like a self-awareness that makes him less odious. You know, I mean, it's helpful as a reader to think, okay, so he sees himself, he knows himself. I have a question about your course, The Psychology of Compelling Storytelling. That sounds really interesting to me. The course description says, novice storytellers tend to associate the quality of a story with the quality of its prose. While a clear and concise style will facilitate understanding, the commercial success of, quote, poorly written books demonstrates that good storytelling, the kind of storytelling that fascinates and persuades, calls for a different skill, the ability to create urgency. So yeah, that's very interesting. And I think it will be interesting to my listeners because, I mean, there's always a little bit of bitterness when you find that horrible book that's selling, you know, gazillions of copies and you see everybody reading it on the beach, right? But there must be some quality of urgency that's working in that book, right?
Yeah. And we have to accept that. So I think there are very, very good writers who just doesn't know how to make their book engaging. And I was one of them. Well, I'm calling myself a good writer, but
That's okay. Your book has urgency.
Yeah. No, I created urgency. This book was totally designed. When I started my PhD, my goal was to figure out how to make a story more engaging. And I wanted to understand the process inside the head. And so there are, I think there are two ways of learning how to write. One is to study literature. And I'm not saying that you should choose one way or the other. I think you should mix both of them. One way is to study literature and try to imitate good writers. And the other one is to study human behavior and try to understand why people enjoy what we do. And that's what I teach. I teach a psychology class for writers. And the metaphor that I use at the beginning of the course is that some stories are like cake. They're delicious and hard to resist, but maybe full of empty calories. And then some stories are like raw broccoli. They're nutritious, but not that appetizing. So what we need to create is some sort of broccoli cake that is both nutritious and delicious. That makes you think and reflect and maybe causes some change in the reader. But that is easy to eat and enjoyable. And so that's what I teach, how to make stories enjoyable and how to create urgency and how to use in psychology. So we study examples from literature, but first and foremost, it's a psychology class.
Wonderful. That sounds really interesting.
It's a UCLA extension, if somebody's hearing. And I'm being very successful with the class. It's always full. Not everybody finishes, but yeah. I mean, and my students so far have been great.
Is it an in-person class or a Zoom class?
One version is in person and two are asynchronous.
Okay.
So I have three sections right now.
Okay, cool. Let's see. So... there's another aspect to Charlie's loquaciousness that I thought was interesting. He, as we've said, he talks too much. But that makes for opportunity for humor, but it also makes for opportunities for sharing information as a writer who's trying to share information in interesting ways with the reader. Lots of ways of sharing information, his emotional state, his observations of people like Jignesh. Do you want to just talk a little bit about sharing information on the page? And it doesn't have to be about Charlie talking too much, but all the different ways, like dialogue shares information. And
yeah, I tell my students, tell, don't show, because we've been hammered over and over that we should show. And I think sometimes you need to tell. And what Charlie does is a lot of telling. Sometimes there's some showing. But it doesn't matter if you tell or show. What matters is that you convey information in a way that the reader accepts it, understands it, and you can consolidate in memory easily, especially the important details. There are a lot of details that just give color to the conversation that you enjoy at the moment, but that you don't remember in the long term, and that's fine. I mean, with Charlie, he gives a lot of irrelevant information that you may forget, but you enjoy at that moment. But the important information stays with you. If you want something to stay with the reader, it has to be connected to a strong emotion, and especially negative emotions. So if things are neutral, we forget about them. It's like we never forget what we ate, the menu for a wedding, for instance, or I don't know, one fantastic meal that we had. I was in Chicago last year, and we went to this restaurant, Veggie House. I highly recommend it. It was the most delicious eggplant that I had. I still dream about it. So you never forget that because it created strong emotions. If you don't provoke a strong emotion, the reader is going to forget. And then also you need to use redundancy and repeat information that you want the reader to keep. Otherwise, we'll forget. And try to, we say that showing is to appeal to the senses. You don't really appeal to the senses. What you appeal is to sensorial memories, to what things that we experience. So to is explicit and non-explicit long-term memory. So things that we have experienced in the past. In another interview, they told me like, oh my God, I love your description of the house of Jignesh and this and that. And it's from the point of view of Charlie. And Charlie says very, very little about the house. But he makes a point that there is no designer furniture there. And he says, no Modernica, no this and that. So you're getting to know much more about Charlie, and you create your own version of the house based on the cues that he gives, but you don't need exact details. Mm-hmm. You just need to have, I mean, most of the responsibility will be on the reader. Mm-hmm. You just have to give indications of what kind of memories to retrieve into consciousness.
Okay, great. One of your blurbs reads, funny, shocking, and depraved, this novel warns us about what happens when our darkest impulses drag themselves into the light. And that just reminded me of this quote by Thomas Harris, who wrote Silence of the Lambs, who sort of talked about how a writer has to go to these very dark places when writing dark work, right? I don't remember specifically, but, you know, he sort of was saying, don't try not to go there because you're worried about yourself or because you're being mm-hmm. defensive about your own evil nature. But I'm wondering, do you ever worry about your own darkest impulses as you write?
Well, I think if you put it in writing, it's a way of liberating yourself of bad thoughts. And I mean, one of the reasons why we read is to escape and try somebody else's point of view on what would my life be like if I were an astronaut or if I were a princess or if I were a pirate and stuff. And that's sort of what you get with this book. What would my life be if I was a horrible person and I was mean as Jignesh and Charlie, if I stole money as Jignesh does? And you can't enjoy that, and then you don't realize is that attractive. And so it's like you leave that. You enjoy it in the book, but you can decide. You decide, well, it's not for
now
me.
Now I can walk away. I can go back into being a good guy.
Exactly.
You mentioned some of your influences, including Balzac. And I'm wondering what you've been reading lately, either classics or contemporary literature. And it doesn't have to be fiction, whatever you might have read lately that you enjoyed, that you would recommend to listeners.
I'm reading a book called Underneath that called my attention. It's by Lily Huang. based on a real case, but the book, the whole book is fiction. So it's about a woman that killed all her children by, she was obese and just lay on them and killed them.
Oh my
and
God.
It's a very dark, it's a horrible crime, but she does a very good work of explaining how she felt and maybe why she did it. You don't forgive her crime. You just understand her anger and bitterness. And it's a very heavy book. I mean, you have to take your pauses because some parts are really not graphic. It's not, there's no gore, but you feel the emotional weight of how miserable her life was. And but it's very good. And I'm rereading Causing Pons right now. I mean, I love that book. It takes a little bit forever because Balzac loves to give a biography of every single character. And so the plot goes really fast and then stops. And then he gives a long and detailed description of the life of this person. Then it goes back to the plot. And so you have to have patience. But if you are into that kind of books, I mean, you're going to love it. I highly, highly recommend it. And it's very campy. It's also about two gay guys. But in this case, they are nice people, and the horrible people are everyone else around them. It's a wonderful book, and so that's what I'm reading right now.
Okay, wonderful. What are you working on? Do you have something you're writing next? Oh yeah, you said you're almost done. You said.
No, I'm one third, I think, or one half, depending on how much work I put on it. And so I don't know if it's going to work or not. It's about a little kid, super gay. And I'm not sure if it's going to be transgender because right now he's only 14. And so he wants to be a girl. And I'm exploring that part. And but it's the way I describe it is YA for adults. It's not YA for teenagers. It's YA for adults that like to read YA.
Okay.
Because some adults like YA. It's not pornographic or anything like that, but it's humor, more satire, more like The Onion, I would say.
Yeah.
You got to be older to laugh. And so he is the assistant to a witch. And he's fascinated by the witch's house, and she used to be an actress, and the witches are horrible, and he has to take care of them, and they have 13 dogs, and I was inspired by a story that I heard on the radio about a guy that he's from Mexico and he never transitioned properly. He was more of a transvestite than a transgender. And he liked to sing and dress like a woman. And he was very poor and he was living in a very small garage. And the radio story told the whole story. And I was like, oh my God, I would like to write about something like this. And at one point he tells that he has a little hernia. And a witch told him that he had to steal a potato and put the potato there to stop the hernia. And I said, I'm going to write that story. How the witch told him to put a stolen potato. So that's what I'm doing.
When you say a witch, are you talking about a fantasy element in novel, or are you talking about a real Wiccan or something?
No, it's a fantasy one, but I like my witches evil, so they're funny, and you end up liking them, but they're abusive not too abusive, and they're just a mess. I think, they're alcoholic. They're alcoholics. They play cards. They make voodoo dolls to survive, and they have a lot of dogs.
When you are working on the next thing, is it hard to get the last thing out of your head? Like, do you have Jignesh and Charlie trying to make their way into this new book?
I have started writing a new book in the middle of another book. So not really. I started this when I needed a rest from Jignesh and Charlie, because I thought, oh my God, these people are too evil. So I have to write about someone that is kind of sweet. And that's how I came with this child. So not really, but a little bit. I have one character that I just loved. It's a demon from my previous novel. And so I think he's making his way into this novel as well.
I always like to ask for advice for writers who are listening. And in your case, I wanted to talk about the campy humor. And, you know, sometimes it's really over the top. But I wondered, what are the rules you set for yourself as far as how far you're going to take it? And maybe in revision, how far will you pull it back? And, you know, like one of the things that I'll mention is that Jignesh kills someone. So the way that Jignesh kills this person is kind of angry and campy and humorous, but horrible. So anyway, and that worked. I mean, obviously it worked. You've won a wonderful award and gotten your book published and everything. But if it goes too far, is it still a good impulse? And do you have rules that you set for yourself or not so much?
Yes, in my previous novel, which is also a campy, I call it a horror farce, and it was a fantasy mixed with a historical fiction, I have a description of a witch's Sabbath. And in my head, it was very funny and it was hilarious. And there were all these children that were that made petty crimes, and one stole money from her mother's purse, and another one ate candy when they shouldn't. And so they are all being eaten by the devil. And I thought it was funny, because I thought most people will see it as a funny, but some people got really scared. And so that's when I realized, okay, you have to cause distress to arouse people's interest, but not so much that they will prefer to put the book away. So my book is not for everyone, but for the kind of audience that I was thinking, and my book, I would say, is for 30 and older, preferably 40 and older. The older you are, the more you enjoy the book. And I don't know why exactly, but younger people tend to be a little bit more literal. If you say things like the monster of inflation, like kids imagine a real monster, like small kids. But adults get the metaphor and they get the gist. So my book is a little bit like that. It's full of metaphors and caricatures of real people that you recognize them and then you laugh. No, the title started because the first chapter was coffee, which I took it out. So I ended up taking the first four chapters to the trash. But the first chapter was coffee. The second chapter was shopping, and then I like how it sounded. So that's how, that's okay. And originally it was coffee, shopping, love, murder. But then I realized, okay, no, it's murder, love.
All right. Coffee, Shopping, Murder, Love, published by Red Hen Press and the winner of the Red Hen Quill Award. And my guest today has been Carlos Allende, the author of the book. Thank you so much for speaking with me.
Thank you for having me. I'm very happy to be here.
From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. That was an interview with Carlos Allende. You can learn more at redhen.org, which is his publisher's website. This week's Write the Book prompt was generously suggested by my guest, Carlos Allende. Create a character that does something reprehensible or immoral. The person can be anyone, a child who broke the rules, or a serial killer. Make that character sympathetic by helping your reader feel compassion for him or her.
You can do this by making your character's pain salient and undeserved. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and tune in next week for another prompt or suggestion. Much of the work on Vermont dairy farms is done by people from Latin America. Over 1,000 migrant laborers from Mexico and other countries milk cows, fix tractors, shovel manure, and take care of calves in our state. The Vermont Reads 2022 choice, The Most Costly Journey, El Viaje Más Caro, tells the stories of 19 of these workers in their own words. Illustrated by New England cartoonists in a variety of styles, each short chapter describes aspects of life as an immigrant farm worker in Vermont, crossing the southern border, struggling with English, adapting to winter, growing gardens, raising children, dealing with health crises, and working long hours. Vermont Humanities Council invites Vermont communities to take part in Vermont Reads 2022 by planning projects centered around The Most Costly Journey and its themes of migration, farming, mental health, cartooning, family, labor movements, and the Latinx experience, among others. The start date for Vermont Reads 2022, The Most Costly Journey, is July 1st, and applications for projects will be accepted through June 30th. More information at vermonthumanities.org. I would love your feedback about the show. Let me know if you'd like me to interview certain authors or if you have events to announce. Be sure to tell your friends about Write the Book and about the podcast site, writethebook.podbean.com, where you can get all the archived episodes. New and recent episodes of Write the Book are available wherever you get your podcasts. Just subscribe to have them sent to your podcast app. A reminder to listeners who write, I do share a writing prompt each week, so be sure to check the archives of Write the Book if you'd like to find any that you might have missed. You can also access the podcast and link to our social media presence at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. If you like the show, please rate it where you find it. Talk about it with people who might enjoy it. Up next at 5, stay tuned for Feminist Frenzy, the radio show with a feminist agenda. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro, and you've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM, WBTV, LP, Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. Stay well and have a great week.